Welcome to Coffee and Divination, a podcast about the arts of obtaining hidden knowledge in changing times. Join me, Joanna Farrar, to chat with experts from around the world on tarot, runes, geomancy, and the many ways divination can help us navigate and plan our paths ahead.
So, thank you to everyone who is joining us live. Thank you, of course, to everyone who's listening afterwards on the podcast. I am very excited to introduce our guest today, Dr. Alexander Cummins. He is a phenomenal scholar. If you haven't heard about him or have seen his writings before, you really should check them out, and I'm sure you will be inspired to do that after hearing him today. His practice as a consultant and also as a scholar centers around religion, philosophy, medicine, and magic. He has a focus on folk magic, necromancy, and divination. He did his doctoral thesis at the University of Bristol, exploring the history of magical approaches to the emotions. His areas of research, which are vast, span topics such as folklore and sorcery, ghost stories and ancestor veneration, and handbooks of demonology and ritual magic. Some of his releases include an excellent book of the Art of Magic, which was released by Scarlet Imprint not too long ago, the Book of the Magi, Lore, Prayers, and Spellcraft of the Three Holy Kings, and the Starry Rubric, 17th Century English Astrology and Magic. And that's just some of your works. So thank you for being here today.
Gosh, thank you for having me. Thanks very much. It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to talk, pot drinks and magic. I'm drinking tea. I have the taste buds of a child. It's very difficult for me to enjoy coffee if it's not like smothered in chocolate. I hope that's not breaking the rules too quickly.
No, I'm actually kind of more of a tea drinker myself as well, despite the name of the podcast. So
it's friendly. People, there's a cultural context, of course. Yeah. I should point out straight off the bat that I always worry, being befuddlingly English, I always worry that people will think that we chose the title, An Excellent Book of the Art of Magic. It's a 16th century grimoire and the scrying and the dream journal and scrying record of the two operators who kind of received the grimoire, and that's what they called it. They were not burdened by an overabundance of humility.
No,
and so we're reporting what they called it. We didn't just decide, like, I wrote it with my friend Phil, and we didn't just decide, like, oh my god, we've written such an excellent book of magic. Got similarly criticized for the fact that we used the 16th century spelling of magic, which not only has a K on it, but they even put an E on the end, which is just right out there,
Just add, it was a wonderful project.
It was a wonderful project to get to work on. Yeah.
Well, I definitely I have some questions for you. I want to talk about that a little later in the interview. Definitely.
Sure.
It is an excellent book, I will say, regardless of whether you titled it that, obviously. So I want to just get started by talking a little bit of, if you could tell us a little bit of your background. I mean, you are a very respected already scholar. So you've written for scholarly as well as, more esoteric publications. And your background, your scholarship in astrology and magic is extensive. So my question is, when you were growing up and you were getting interested in this, it's kind of a chicken or the egg question. Did you have a fascination with an interest in practicing magic when you were younger and that grew into the history of it? Or was it the other way around or kind of both at the same time?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I feel like I'm still interrogating it. I think as a historian, I'm very interested in historiography, the history of histories. Like, not just what did the Tudors do, but what did the Victorians think the Tudors did, right? And I feel like there's a personal historiography that emerges with magicians very often, of like, depending on where they are with their thing, it's very easy for us to like find, the foreshadowing, the bleeding writing on the wall was right there, right? You're always a weird kid. For me, it was it's kind of a combination of those factors. It was definitely not just there was an interest in like folklore and mythology and things. I grew up in Birmingham in the 80s, and an awful lot of like really right on kind of left leaning school programmers and things were very big on us not having more riots over the oppression of people of color in the country, not unlike other Birminghams, for instance, over here. Mm-hmm. And one of their wonderful solutions, getting at how many kids from all over the place and from many, many different cultures and religions and backgrounds and family setups were, you know, in these inner city Birmingham schools. We went through an awful lot of like West African folklore and things like that, which are you know, a big part of my religion these days. You know, getting involved in Lukumi and other attendant traditions. So there was that. I'm also like a chick tract come to life in many ways. I was playing Dungeons and Dragons with my dad and his friends from the age of about four. So I think I probably learned to write my name on character sheets. I say that sometimes, and a small portion of the serious occultists in the room are like, oh, cool, we can talk about like D&D and nerd stuff. And a little sizable portion get like kind of a little affronted and are like, oh, so you're a, you know, like we aren't doing it properly. It amazes me how many professional magicians are like in the closet about also, you know, painting like model trains or things like that, because they think that the cultural community will like see them as not proper in some sense. But what I got out of playing D&D as a very small kid with a bunch of like grown-ups and safe, you know, my dad's friends and these extended aunts and uncles and things, was, you know, collaborative, imaginative play, storytelling, non-competitive gaming. And I think some of those skills are clearly transferable in terms of, you know, not just turning your LARP into a magic circle, but like for wider skills around teamwork and collaboration. And of course, making folklore work for you, resolving, you know, building emotional tension and releasing it. I think there's a lot to be said. I'm working on a class that's like occultism for gamers or something like that at the moment. So a lot of these thoughts are a little close to the surface right now. But between like a scholastic interest, which only carried on, and a practical interest in gaming, I guess you could say, and imagination and play, a bunch of, you know, experiences, which were less like, you know, seeing a walls bleeding or seeing a gray lady, and more like going around a lot of old places, old churches and manor houses and National Trust places and things as a kid, and wandering around places that people had been for a very long time, and feeling the layers of people, like a less particular model of like, oh, there's a ghost that I just felt pass, and more like a sense of the ambient dead, which was a concept I wouldn't find or explore until much, much later, but instantly made sense to me. Mm-hmm. I guess the other piece is being involved in martial arts as a kid, at least from like 6 to 16, doing an awful lot of Aikido, and doing it at an especially like, it was a strange mixture of, on the one hand, it was a very flowery form of Aikido. It was very soft. It was exactly the kind of thing that people that listen to Joe Rogan say, like, you couldn't do in a real bar fight. It was exactly that kind of like, we're interested in circles and balance and like, you know, back and forth and testing energies and things. And so it was very, very soft, but it was also done almost exclusively by big, burly auto workers in the place we did it in Birmingham, because it was right next to one of those plants, the Longbridge plant. And so it was full of like a lot of very, very hard working class men who were just like very committed to trying to become Jedi. Like they were, that was absolutely what they were about. And, you know, Aikido has a lot of stuff about ki and, you know, strange spirits and things. And Ueshiba was involved in all sorts of interesting associations and it seems working covens and things like that, if we want to call them that. And so I guess those kind of all came together in terms of, I feel like martial arts gives a background not just in being in your body, but in breath, like actually making a difference as to whether or not you're able to do something or perceive something. And so between those kinds of things, I hope that's not just like a rambly answer. I feel like there's a, you know, a mm-hmm. concatenation of factors of like, why are you like this?
Well, I don't think anyone could give a 5-minute explanation of why are you who you are, but I think it's interesting because I have an interest in D&D as well. So I will be in team geek if you're the occultist. But I, you know, and Aikido and martial arts is also a fascination of mine, but I think they both have that element of both creativity, but also like structure and something that is a form that you kind of work within, and then you can come to better understandings or interesting places in the stories.
Oh gosh, or kata, yeah. Like yeah. The idea of like repeating something, like whether or not that's like full Rinzai Zen of like, you are going to make 100 sword cuts and you're going to try and achieve that like no-minded perfect kind of go with the flow / focus thing, which is not a contradiction in terms at all, Western mind. Yeah, whether that's very helpful, and partly from that 19th century model of like, it's not actually the exercise that's important, it's building your stick-to-itiveness and your sheer bloody-mindedness to like count to 1,000 every day or something like that, like these kinds of exercises. So it has a little bit of that, but I literally also think it's actually useful. Much so.
Yeah, I came from a Suzuki trained violin background. That's so it was very much do it 10,000 times and then then we can talk type of thing.
Right.
That's very, very interesting. So, in all of that, since this is a podcast about divination, what are some of your first experiences with divination itself? Was it a fascination with astrology, which is what you kind of got into later? Did you have family members that read cards or anything like that, or did it come to you kind of later as part of the magical practice that you then got interested in a little later?
I think the first time I was properly studying was probably having gone through, I was reading, you know, if only for like flavor and stuff, because I was interested abstractly reading Crowley at like, you know, before my teens, but I wasn't actually putting anything into, other than, I don't know, putting into practice and awareness and things like that, but not really like consciously thinking of myself as practicing magic or divination until, you know, my teens and getting into, you know, chaos magic and things like that, the unreliable gateway drug. And from there, you know, realizing, you know, taking this meta modeling thing seriously and being like, okay, well, I need to find a nice sturdy model that could be, if anything, the opposite of this thing that chaos. And so myself on a trajectory that doesn't seem that unusual, went from, you know, do I want chaos magic and like freeform augury to getting very interested in Hermetic Kabbalah and the Golden Dawn and all of that, you know, 19th century stuff, and studying tarot as a result of learning, you know, HQBL. And I think what was helpful for that is realizing that it wasn't just about memorizing different things that cards meant, but it was actually keyed into the cosmology. And so, you know, on a good day, you can be like, this isn't just a seven of discs that's failure. It's about, you know, what's Crowley saying? Venus's customary enfeebling effect, which is, you know, a thing we can unpack then, right? And talk about, you know, his relationship with gender and like your relationship with gender and a bunch of other things, along with, you know, broader concepts of netzach and so on. And while I, you know, I have a lot of problems with a lot of that material now, for me in my practice, at least, I'm not trying to start any arguments with anyone. It was very important to me at the time. And I think, again, thinking about divination, not just as a list of correspondences of possible meanings, but as expressions of different things that the cosmos do, right? It's flavors, it's building blocks, it's processes, it's proclivities, those kinds of things. So, no, I didn't really grow up with anyone like reading cards or anything. My great grandmother had much more of the dead were just around. You just set the table for them and things like that, and talk to them as if they were there, or talk to them as if you just like called them into the other room. Like they were in the house, but they weren't with you there. So she'd like call to folks who'd gone and things like that. But no, it was. It was tarot primarily, and then quickly geomancy as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you had that already in your family, which is, I would say, in some cases, more connection to the ancestors than some people's families do in like what is considered normal Western culture these days. So that's really interesting.
My great grandmother, Big Nan, who was smaller than Little Nan, because big was about how generation, not size, which is very confusing as a child. was a very strange woman, bless her. She was a very early adopter of some of the folks coming over and teaching pranayama yoga in the 50s, having lied about her age to get out of Ireland on a nursing program to get to England and do that. So she was devoutly Irish Catholic, had plenty of her saint devotions, talked to our dead who were around, and I asked her once, you know, how do you resolve doing this like energy model stuff with, I didn't say that at the time I was a kid, you know, how do you resolve your breathing stuff and when your eyes go funny with this? And she's like, I just don't tell the priest, you know, that seems a very traditional Catholic way of doing things, right? Yeah. He does his thing and I do my thing. And occasionally those meet, mm-hmm. but I don't worry him about things he doesn't need to be worried about.
Yeah, if it doesn't directly involve, then it doesn't have to involve. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's got enough on his plate opening up a little portal to heaven every Sunday, you know. I don't want to, you know, no need to bother him with what I'm up to.
Mm-hmm. So you had that interest in tarot, or, you know, you started developing that when you were doing chaos magic then. You are, of course, a consultant with geomancy and cartomancy, playing card divination, and tarot. So for readings, you offer basically those three things as options for people. So when did your interest in, geomancy, but also the playing card divination separately from tarot, even though obviously they're related, but different arts, kind of?
Playing card divination, I got through looking at, honestly, it was through working with a couple of grimoire spirits that their offices, their kind of like list of superpowers and, you know, turn-ons and turn-offs has, I was looking for spirits who could teach me more divination. Mm-hmm. I was going through human sources and I was also looking for, you know, other sources, I'm big on tutelary shades, you know, calling spirits to teach you about how to work with more spirits, mm-hmm. on a grand old make the magic circle a positive feedback loop kind of thing. And they were all about card divination because that's one of the older forms of divination, you know, throughout the European, not just spirit work traditions, but just generally like European, like both gaming and divination. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, yeah, sure, we can teach you about all divination, but really we want to talk, and because some of them mentioned specifically cards. And so I was like, okay, I guess I better learn some cards so I can understand what these spirits are trying to tell me. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky to stumble onto a wonderful text by a conjure worker, Professor Charles Porterfield, who is now my very dear friend. I'm very grateful to say. So yeah, it's funny how those things work out. But yeah, that book and I think really sorted me out. A deck of spells, I would thoroughly recommend, not just anyone who's interested in learning cartomancy, but anyone who wants to see a good written book about divination at all. It's half exploration of different, for want of a better term, correspondences, different sets of meanings for the cards, then a synthesis of all of these kinds of traditional things, noting that most of the fours that turn up are a kind of bed, for instance, whether that's a sick bed or a lover's bed or a marriage bed, you know, or a travel away from home bed, right? Working on the road bed. And so he kind of synthesized all these. And then the second half of the book is a deck of spells, is practical sorcery to do with every card in the deck that can do different things. When we start utilizing the tools of divination for sorcery, we find the sorcery out of the sortilage, so to speak, right? You're playing with the lots of fate. And just as, you know, if you pulled the sun card exactly when you're about to go and shine a job interview, you might carry that card with you. The act of divination in some way sacralizes that thing. It's a significator now, and has some of the power of that thing, whether that's a magical link back to the situations you're reading on, or otherwise, you know, handles or what Chumley calls like points of transmutability, right? Little parts of fate. Everything, you know, each one of those pieces is an image of the fate that it's predicting or encouraging us to consider. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Charles has a lot of stuff about that in the book, and so I would thoroughly recommend it if people are interested. The other fact is it's just really practical. I found myself reading. I was a performance poet for a while, and would do emceeing around the UK festival circuit with a couple projects. One of which was some friends up in Leeds who bought a big top together and took a cabaret around. And so I would do cabaret in the evening, and I would work in the various things called healing fields in the days, and seeing how, how do I phrase this without sounding antagonistic, that there are an awful lot of people doing great work with tarot for very exploratory, very reflective, very open-ended kind of sessions and explorations and kind of reflection and meditations and things like that. And I found myself just much more interested in being able to answer definitive yes or no questions in a way that was responsible and helpful. And so for me, playing cards offered a lot more like, yes, this is going to happen, rather than like, well, let's think about the nature of time, you know, like for me, tarot is a lot more often like a wonderful, batty aunt. And I have a lot of batty aunts, so maybe that says more about me than it does about tarot. But like, it's sometimes that like long walk on a short tangent reveals things that you never thought you'd want to look at. And so I never want to say like I don't really do tarot much anymore. But I don't do tarot a lot for my professional clients because I have, you know, attempted to carve a little niche that's about like, you know, less about reflecting abstractly, although I'm still, you know, more than happy to do that with clients. But trying to get at what you need to do now, bearing in mind you're trying to achieve such and such, you know, which is what I find cartomancy very good at, and what I find geomancy incredibly good at, giving, you know, very grounded, practical advice or perspectives on what to do now, bearing in mind you're trying to achieve such and such, which I find way more helpful than, you know, the predictive parts of most oracles I've explored is the one most prone to human error, right? And so dealing with possibility and how patterns play into each other, which, again, not to be an evangelist for it, but geomancy has some very kind of vaguely, uniquely dialectic qualities of this pattern and this pattern will always produce this kind of pattern. And so it's has a lot more ways of exploring interaction and reactivity and affect and what people do about those things. And so from starting a reading on what you need to concentrate on now, we can actually get pretty deep into a lot of those reflective spaces anyway. It just comes front up of like, this is what you have to do, rather than here's all the things this might mean, and now we'll get eventually to practical action about this. So starting from there is again something that geomancy is very good at. It will synthesize down the answer of the whole chart to something really pithy, and usually a yes, that'll probably happen, or no, that probably won't happen.
Yeah,
and here's why.
Yeah, geomancy is an art that fascinates me. I obviously haven't practiced it or studied it anywhere near like you have, but I think it's a wonderful art form that I'm glad is, you know, gaining more interest and more practitioners these days, because it is so deep. But it brings up a geomancy deep dive, maybe a different conversation, maybe another interview, because I would love to do that. But it's interesting because it brings up one of the weaknesses that it kind of, in some sense, might have led to geomancy falling out of favor, which was the whole, oh, well, now there's just lists of tables and all you have to do is look up the judge and the left and the right witness and you're done. And and then that led to sort of a dissipation of people's understanding of how deep the art could be. If you just look at that and think you're done, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a victim of its own success is how it's often put, right? That it becomes so popular and so many people are doing it that more and more summarizing documents are coming out. So from, you know, delineations of the 198 of the results of the 16 figures and the 12 houses, 192, sorry, I can do maths. you know, each of them used to have like whole paragraphs on like, if you're asking about this thing, it's going to relate to this and this and this and this. And gradually, partly through its popularity, those just get, you know, yeah, like you say, like more and more concise and more summarized until it's literally down to like, is this figure in this place? It is good. Like, good when? Like, for what? In what way?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The elements of class and gender are really interesting in that as well, in that geomancy seems to have been practiced by a lot more, you know, for want of a better term, poor people. And people that aren't men, these strange people living amongst us even now, wearing women's clothes, being women. And so there's also this element of, oh, if you don't have some nice astrology to base your work on, if you're not looking at the you know, the unfolding starry cosmos, if you're just grubbing about in the earth and trying to, you know, answer practical questions like, will the cow live or not, as opposed to, you know, grand questions like what is the King of Poland doing? To pick two examples from the top and the bottom of, you know, early modern English divination, then it's, you know, it's seen as a parlor game. And as a result, you know, more people can print more things that are just like, oh, it's, you know, it's lookup tables and it falls out of
And that also favor. Becomes a class thing where it's like, well, oh, that's more of the people. That's yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Don't you have a man to do that for you?
Oh, well. So you were already saying that you gravitate towards, you know, playing card divination and geomancy for that practicality, that ability to answer a question, which obviously if somebody's coming to you, you know, they would like an answer. They need help for something, in whatever sense that is. Are there types of questions that between those two, or even if you want to include like, you know, possibly tarot, are there types of questions where you might say to someone, yeah, you know, this geomancy would be best suited for this as opposed to playing cards? Or is it just kind of in the moment or another situation?
No. I'm pretty clear these days about which modality I find most useful. Mm-hmm. If it's a straightforward just yes, no, and you don't really need to explore why, playing cards. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying playing cards can't, but for me, I get to a certain complexity in terms of like, this is the case and this is not the case and this is what's going on. And anything more complicated than that, I'd shift to geomancy because that's still got that like practicality. But there's again, not a deep dive, but a geomantic shield can be considered like a 15 card spread. There are 15 places that fit one of the 16 answers the figures will go, and they can repeat across the chart. And the first 12 of those places are assigned to the houses of the heavens. So if you're asking about like your love life, that's going to presumably you're going to focus on the seventh house, Uxor, house of partners, wives, all kinds of partners, not just romantic ones, but you're going to look there. But then you're also going to look at the last three places in the chart after those initial 12, the court, the two witnesses and the judge, and they literally distill down the whole reading. And so there's a couple of places you can look to see where things are going on. So you don't just get a cartomancy, you'll just get a yes or no, you know, and you might get some. It's not true. You can get a sense of why. I usually just stick to a three card reading with playing cards, although seven and nine are also present themselves as useful things as well. And that, so if people want to get into why that's the case or what the moving parts of the situation are, I'd say geomancy. And if people want to... for people who are interested in something where it might still be a very pressing concern, but it's less a, will this happen or how do I make this happen? And it's more a, what do I need to consider about? I often recommend, depending on what people want to do, I often recommend a tarot reading for like clients of mine who are artists and going through some kind of creative block, for instance, because that opens them up to a vast array of emblems and loci of affective like virtue and the ability to do things, you know, in the mind and outside in the world. That said, even then, you know, the difference between do you want a reading that will give you a bunch of things to ponder on and some like great dream fodder, or do you want a reading that's like, you need to take these three herbs, do this bath, you know, at this planetary hour, and you know, make sure that you chuck the water out afterwards, and that will sort you out. Like there are a bunch of different ways of approaching this. You know, mm-hmm. I think tarot is good for, again, to pick an example out of the air, like creative block. You know, I think tarot is good for helping people explore. The way I do it, at least, is good for helping people explore, you know, whole vast interior worlds and things, and that's wonderful and powerful. And for me, geomancy is my role a little bit more as a like magic plumber who can turn up and be like, this is the thing that you need to unblock this, or this needs to flow more easily, or these need to be connected, or there's a leak here, and this is causing the equivalent of water damage. And you come in and do these definitive things and it helps, you know. And that's where not just reading a whatever oracle you have as a like, here's what to do about this thing, but also like, here is where different flavors of the cosmos are doing their thing, and knowing about how Mars do, especially coming out of a Venus thing and going into a Saturnine thing. You know, that's a very particular modality of effects and instantiations of those effects. And so being able to say, well, there looks like there's this influence, and if you do this thing about it, means that you're on the once being very practical, but also still fundamentally engaging and being a part of the elementated sublunary world, right? So geomancy has an awful lot of elements to it in various ways. The elements are everywhere and every level of geomancy, as are the planets. And so when you're doing that, you can come up with some very practical stuff. My doctorate is on, the shortest answer is Wizards and Feelings, magical approaches to the passions in early modern Europe and 17th century England specifically. So experience and expression and mapping, managing and manipulating those experiences and expressions of passions. And so I looked at a lot of humoral theory, and I still look at a lot of humoral theory, which, yes, is a personality, is a BuzzFeed test. Yes, you are a Samantha, you are a Raphael, whatever that, you know, however you want to do that. It's really fun to play humoral theory with any quartet, whether that's the Beatles, you know, Scooby-Doo or Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles. These are useful academic exercises, you know.
Of course, it's only about that, I'm sure, yeah.
So studying humoral theory, yes, is bad medicine, is a personality test, but it's also an understanding of the influences and flavors of situations, of places, of relationships. Those have humors running through them too, you know, and not always obvious connections, you know. And so geomancy, amongst other things, maps interrelation between how, you know, this lunary force and this martial force can produce this weird Jupiterian thing, you know, through the nature of how it plots elemental engagements, which is, after all, what's happening in the sublunary world, right? It's elements compounding and mixing and matching and producing a cosmos of both, where both change and stability can occur, right? We aren't just like all sloshing into a beige mess because all these qualities are all interacting with each other, and we equally aren't living in an unchanging, you know, blank white heaven where nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And so charting how a fiery impulse or someone speaking hotly to you can produce different things within yourself, but you're also porous and that can affect your environment and your environment can affect you back. Like charting all those things I find very helpful. And so being able to see, again, yeah, see the moving parts of what's going on and present. Sometimes the mediation is have a dream about this stuff, right? Sometimes it's go off and my job is to help you get clarity on what you're seeing, not tell you what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And there again is, you know, the ethics of what's my job as a diviner and what's the job of the client, you know, which what I love, you know, rambling at people and forums like this about, I find very helpful, you know. And also one of the things that I was excited to talk to you about in terms of, you know, where you feel when we're, you know, setting too much homework as diviners versus when we're helping someone like do something that will be helpful for them, you know.
Mm-hmm. That ties into another question I wanted to ask a little later, so I'll kind of skip to that. It's kind of goes, you've kind of already answered it to a degree, but I kind of want to go at it a slightly different angle. When you talk about your role as a diviner, when you're working on behalf of somebody else and you're helping them with a question, there's a spectrum of different ways that people interact, obviously, and think about their role and how they get that information and how they present it to people. There's, I mean, perhaps this is more of like a tarot thing. I'm not really sure if it would be considered different with geomancy, but there can be people who the information almost feels like it's sort of channeled. Like they see the cards, they're telling a story, there's a flow to it. They simply just get that information out to the person, you know, as clearly and as simply and as quote unquote easily, you know, as much of that almost kind of like divinely inspired sort of story that they're giving to that person. And then it's kind of more up to the client, maybe with the diviner's help afterwards, to sort of like pick through and see how that interacts and how their story fits in with that they've been given. And then there's other people that have more the, I will sit down with them and we'll see how they interact with this card or with this figure. And then how does that then lead to this one? How is that impacting them? And we'll go through it. And it's a very back and forth with the person. Do you know what I mean? And that's obviously a spectrum. I'm not saying it's one or the other, but.
No. Yeah. And it's got to be a case by case basis.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to evangelize for geomancy, again, one of the things it can do is trace not just what the answer is or what the client is currently experiencing. If you can add figures together, basically, because it's like a travel Yi Ching, you know, broken and unbroken lines. So it's a binary system, but only four lines rather than six for the hexagrams. So you can literally add figures together and work out new odds and evens. So, you know, this figure plus this figure will always equal this figure. This pattern plus this pattern will always produce this pattern. You know, the young boy, the poor, the warrior on the road of life, the twisting, turning river of life, may eventually come to wisdom, the sage, the old man, which is the, you know, how a martial figure, I'm not just doing gang signs here, how a martial figure of 1121 plus a lunar figure of via 1111 will always produce Amicia, like the opposite, sorry, Albus, the opposite. So fiddling about with fingers and not getting specific, you can trace not just the answer to tell them, but also how the client will take it. If the client is marked by a Saturnine figure like Tristicia, figure of sorrow, they're going to concentrate only on the bad news. And it's very, and you have to be careful about how you present that stuff. So you can trace, you can look, you can see in the chart how they're going to take this. And so if you don't know that, then yeah, it's, that's its own thing of like, I can't tell how you're going to feel about this thing. That's not what I'm reading on. There's an argument that, you know, that's asking how someone is going to take something might be verging on a little bit like getting at things they know without their consent necessarily. I think that's perhaps a little far in those. I think that's taking that a little far. But if you don't know, then you're going to have to, you know, try and do your best. But one of the advantages of the Oracle I use is that it will let you know how they're going to take that news. Which again can seem very counterintuitive to, you know, they're really chipper, the news is really chipper, but if those two patterns produce some weird thing, then you need to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can help in a better way if you know that in advance, so that, you know, if you're aware of that as you're going through, it's going to be better for the other person as well as you. So
And I see the position where people are like, I am not going to candy coat things. That's, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat things. The phrase that gets used a lot on forums and stuff. Right. And I have time for that. You know, you should respect someone enough to tell them the truth. I get that. But also, if you have no regard for how someone is going to interpret your message, are you really a messenger at that point?
Yeah.
You know, if you're like, there's a difference between, you know, knocking on someone's door and handing them a letter and like, trying to throw it through their window, you know? And if you are genuinely trying to help people, and this isn't about, you know, even on any level, just trying to impress them with how magic you are, then, you know, I think we also need to be aware of the other side of like, yes, no, don't sugarcoat things, but also don't, you know, don't frame things in ways that people can't understand or usefully engage with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because then how much help is that really? It's at a certain point becomes harmful. So, when you are going to do, like, when you're about to cast a chart or something like that, do you have a process that you go through that you can share some of with us, like a little bit of how you frame readings and things like that, that you've found helpful? Sure. I'm sure. I mean, it's obviously personal, but if you feel comfortable sharing.
No. Yeah. I mean, that's also professional. Yeah, for sure. So, when I sit down to read for a client, I will mostly, so there's how a session works, and there's also how, like, my individual tools I'm using. For instance, I'm a big fan of using beaded loops to divine inside, to demark, like, the space in which I am about to divine, for a couple reasons. There's a way of ensuring that it's a meeting space for your spirits, the spirits of the oracle, and the client's spirits. Also ensures that, you know, I take very seriously this idea that, you know, a chart is also an image of the conditions and can be used talismanically, but also might call those things to bear when you are ritualizing a reading, you know, and a bad card or a bad figure falls, like that thing is now more present. And so some things might need to be done to calm that down again. Geomancy has options around, like, depending on the first figure that falls, some of those figures halt the chart and says, you know, Rubius is a figure of deceit. So it doesn't just say there is deceit around you, but that this chart may deceive you and that not all times are good to divine on. So extra ritual kind of apparatus, like armbands and stuff, around ensuring that we're both doing this as safely as possible. So I use beaded loops in a variety of ways, circlets, which combine, you know, classic lapidary of antiquity, medieval and early modern, and some modern stuff, you know, utilizing stones with Jupiterian virtues for the circlet I use when I'm reading on Thursdays, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I honor the planetary spirits of the day because they're also completely cooked into the system I use, like Planets in there. I will typically get the client to generate the first figure, which, given that Geomancies works off these kind of four-line binary of one dot or two dots on each line, the easiest way to generate a geomantic figure is to flip a coin four times. So in a session, we'll talk about what the thing is. We'll work out what areas of the situation we want to look at specifically. So we'll delineate the houses we're quesiting. We'll set the question formally, because that's very important. How we phrase the question depends on whether or not you are. So for instance, yes, you can quesit the sixth house for health, but it depends whether you're asking, is the disease going to get worse? Is the condition going to get worse, or am I going to get better? Right. It depends whether you're asking about the nature of the disease or the nature of your health. And technically, the sixth house is the house of like bad fortune, is the nature of the disease, which is why we want to see loss there. We want to see losing the disease. We don't want to see gain. We don't want to see any of those. Typically, you are getting stronger, because it's actually saying the thing that's making you ill is getting stronger. Mm-hmm. So the phrasing of the question matters. And then from there, I'll set up my loops and my little tokens of the planetary spirits, and so that we're not just having to do Jupiter things on Thursdays, right? So you can read about very Saturnine things, like, I don't know, building a bigger fence to keep your neighbor more separate or something. You can still do that on a Thursday, because I'm honoring all the planetary messengers. And then we'll do two prayers, one of which is the prayer of the gnomes, which is not praying to earth elementals, it is praying with the earth elementals that are associated with the oracle of geomancy. And I really love that prayer, because it's also, you are praying to the god of the gnomes, like you are going to church with them, and it's that simpatico you build by saying, like, you think this is really important, I also think this is really important. They pray to, you know, Pluton is who it seems to be, a dread invisible king who dwells beneath the earth, mm-hmm. Who never withholds the wages of his workforce. He's got this kind of like nice socialist principle going on here that obviously, you know, I'm very fond of, being a red diaper baby, as I believe they're called here. So I'll do that prayer, then I'll do the prayer from my grimoire practice, which is the Astrakios prayer from the Grimoire Verum, which is it's like a Hail Mary Swiss Army knife. Not a Hail Mary, a Swiss Army knife of like prayer of success. It calls in a bunch of spirits that help interact with other spirits to ensure that you are all talking to each other. Then the client will cast the first figure, which also means if it's a figure that halts the reading and says they need to cleanse because the stuff that's going on that we can't get an accurate answer on right now, then we can go through that. And then I will set the rest of the chart and then we'll go through it. So that will also be presaged by, I will prepare to divine by serving the gods I serve and doing the religious practices that help me be grounded and centered, but I don't speak for those gods. Mm-hmm. So that's my thing that I do at the start of the day: refresh water, put candles, pray. But I'm not speaking for these gods or on behalf of them. That's for me to be a better diviner in the system that I use for clients and myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm involved in Lukumi Orisha religion, and there's divining within that that's very, very important, and that, you know, takes years of training as a priest. And so I want to be very clear about, like, I will go to my gods to ask for clarity and strength and wisdom and guidance, of course, but I'm not under any illusions that I am speaking on their behalf or for them. That's for me, not for the clients. Mm-hmm. So that division for me is helpful, because obviously we don't want to like shove practices together in our lives and smoosh. You know, you can do lots of things, but you know, if you can love paintball and also be, you know, a choir boy, but if you bring a paintball gun to choir practice, you know, you might have problems, right? But you're still doing both of those things, and they're still in your life. You are both those things, but maybe being a choir boy helps you, you know, I don't know, like have the connection to God that helps you then go and do paintballing, or vice versa. Or maybe that's not a great example. Maybe that one got
No, I think that's one of the best examples I've ever heard, actually. I really love that. Because it's true, because there are things that do go together that you can say, well, this can be smooshed together, and it works, and there's no problems. I mean, yeah. Maybe sometimes you try something you think will smoosh together, and it really doesn't. But it is important to know that those distinctions exist. And yeah, they're important to honor and keep to, and also not try to blur too many lines.
Yeah.
Paintball versus
fire. The other thing
fire,
I do with setting up for divining is in the course of getting a client to cast the first figure, to flip that coin four times, is that I occasionally people will be like, oh, I have the perfect, like my grandfather's Krugerrand. And I'm like, don't use that, because again, I contend that you can use the image of the chart to do something about the thing that the chart describes, in the same way that, you know, an image, you know, we're pretty familiar with the idea that an astrological image of an eagle can give you some power of the eagle in some way, right? That's mm-hmm. We're familiar with this idea. I think it's like that. So if the reading's full of like real obstacles, like it's going to be a real delayed thing, a really difficult thing that we want to avoid, you can use that coin to clean off some of those conditions, drain off some of that fate that this coin just told you were going to have, and then throw it in a river. Likewise, you know, conversely, if the reading is really good and says there are all these blessings coming to you, you just need to like secure them, you know, you just need to be, you know, just need to open your hands to feel that catch. Then you can use that coin as the basis for a bath or a charm bag or any number or, you know, any number of other ritual actions that can help remediate or secure the situation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think
that's great for distance readings as well. Fantastic for that. It comes from their hands. You know, they are invested. There's consent on every level. You know, makes it way easier.
And that brings up also the an important point. I think that this is pretty clear, but that in the act of doing divination, it doesn't become a passive thing. That it's actually in by its very nature, it can be active, because then you're looking at the conditions that you're in, what situation you're examining, and then developing a plan of action from that. It's not just saying, well, you got the tower, I guess everything just is terrible. It's very important to have context around it.
Yeah. And I think most divination systems that last any time, with people actually having to rely on them, always have remediatory things to do with them. It's never just, this is your karma, mm-hmm. You know?
And yeah, historically throughout history, there's been those practices as well. And that kind of brings up a question that is more philosophical than practical, but it's always interesting to me how people are fascinated, as I am. You are a historian, and the history of systems of divination is very interesting as a study. But I heard you, I think you were speaking on another podcast where you were talking about how, really, if we want to look at the real roots of divination itself, it's a very interesting ride, because we end up going further and further back until we kind of come to the roots of the first time that humans had symbolic thought, that it is really as ancient as our ability to associate symbols with various things. And I was wondering if you just talk a little bit about that and how you view that in the context of history.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the archaeology may have moved on since I last checked. And I struggle with like an academic career of having started and then lost the passwords for multiple academia.edu accounts. I'm just sorting that out now. So it may have been, I've been trying to follow this and there may be more things, but as far as I can tell, you know, we do start with the birth of writing of some kind, or of representation of tokens. And the two big movements in like human history, global human history, that seem to both have a claim to the idea of kind of, if not starting divination, then at least like, you know, done change the game afterwards. And they come down to Chinese poetry, bonfire stories / divination, and Babylonian accounting. Why do we make symbols, which is a tricky word in many contexts, but why do we build these marks that we use as signposts in some cases, or stochastically in other cases, as like, this is an instantiation of this thing. This is, you know, the name of Raphael in a magic circle is said to have, you know, be ontologically linked. These are not just arbitrary semiotic signposts. So be very careful about, and you know, certain historians and anthropologists of occult philosophy have said that's maybe one of the main differences between, quote, you know, post-Enlightenment disenchanted thinking and pre-Enlightenment, like, magical thinking, not the diagnostic DSM-4 magical thinking as a euphemism for schizophrenia, but like literally thinking about a naturally magical world. So either we do it because humans do it because it's easy to keep track of how much grain your neighbors have used and how big their farms are and things like that. And the accounting of these tokens of like, this is a chicken. Like, I'm not even going to write out chicken. Why would, you know, the concept of writing more than one letter for the word with in English two vowels is also strange. So you get phonemes first very often, but using, for want of a better term, these marks or glyphs or symbols, either to track, you know, money and debt, crucially. So it's either an economic or a poetic / speculative. You know, I'm talking about the turtle shells in the fire that they crack in different ways, and then those cracks are thought to have been read. So it quickly did become a divination system. But yeah, so that's we're into the roots of writing, and that's not even getting into, you know, some of the stuff we get in, you know, Central America with people, you know, with knots and other textile arts that are used. So writing isn't necessarily, you know, getting a nice fountain pen on some lovely, you know, parchment paper. There's a bunch of it before then. But how we language and how we produce save points in language and in reality by extension, again, these lots of fate, is at the root of divination, I think. And we're almost in a kind of like, do you think that, yeah, I don't know. I think the question of, do you think that people are more moved by, no, that's my stuff, or do you think they're more moved by, but what will tomorrow be like? And so I think there's, you know, there's, because of course I don't mean to say like, oh, you know, anyone who cares about economics is obviously a soulless robot and anyone that, you know, wants to dream a future is so wonderful. Like, you can't dream that future unless you know where things are. Like, that, it's not, it doesn't have to be an antagonistic thing, but those two seem, from what I gather, and again, there may be more archaeological evidence, but I think that's a useful reflection of, are we concerned with accounting for what's here with the, you know, with the possible follow-up that we may then be able to work out what to do with it next? And that's politics at that point, right? The power to decide what happens with our resources. Mm-hmm. Or is it literally about like speculation and projection and looking for a glimpse of tomorrow today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how those interact? They can't be separated, really. So yeah.
No. Because again, if you all dream, then mm-hmm. you know your light bill gets shut off. You know.
You may not have a chicken to eat tomorrow. So.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So talking about marks and like marking objects and things like that, one of the pieces that I've read of yours was in the book Physical Evidence for Ritual Acts, Sorcery and Witchcraft in Christian Britain, that was edited by Ronald Hutton. And in that you talked about amulet magic in the 17th century, I believe. And that was a really interesting article. And I wanted to ask you, because speaking of things being interrelated, that article was bringing up, of course, that amulets and this idea of the magic of amulets and those marks that were made, like sigils that were on those and the types of metals that were used, was a part of medical practice, but it was very much involving astrology and, of course, some elements of religious practice and things like that. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that and how they were thought to work. I know it's a huge topic, sure. But
no. There is a great example that's so great that not only do other historians use it, many before me and far more experienced, but even some early modern occult philosophers and magicians use it, which is the jam example, the jelly example. So making a astrological amulet especially is like making jam, goes the analogy. And the analogy is that when you are trying to make an amulet, a talisman, there are like 50 different Greek words for different kinds of amulets and talismans, and people will have all sorts of ideas about what means what, which we can address. But for the time being, I'm going to use them interchangeably, even though they aren't necessarily. The first thing you're going to do, like, we're familiar with, perhaps, I hope, the notion of the fruit of the stars, the idea that, like, when the stars are right, when whatever that line from Hare is, you know, about the seventh house happens, that when the stars, like, get their sky maths right, when they're dancing, when their star choreography, we might say, looks nice and does the thing it's meant to do, and people are talking to each other and they pull off that sweet loop-de-loop or whatever it is, that rains down this influence, which instead of thinking of as like a radiation, like you might want to think about as like fruit falling from a tree. It falls when it falls. That's what it's called. You can shake the tree, sure. There are things you can do to like make the tree more likely to fruit, but ultimately it's the tree fruiting that's the thing. So you catch these particular configurations inside the jar, the jam jar is the talisman. And the idea is that you prepare something that is made in the particular metals and bears the particular marks that link it, again, ontologically, that link it in its nature, in its essence, to the planetary virtue or the astrological virtue that you're attempting to catch. And because like moves to like, because the ancient occult axiom that game recognizes game, you make your metal, you make your iron Mars talisman when Mars is in a really great place for offering, you know, strength and success in competitions and physical health and sharp axes or whatever it is you're making, and that it is attracted to that thing because it's made of the same thing, so it's magnetized to it, we could say, and that you catch it in this sterile container, and then you lock it in various ways, and then you keep it and you brew it, and now you have Mars jam that you can have any time of the year, right? You can have all year round because you've captured it and you've preserved it, right? Preserve. And you have, so it's fruited naturally. It's arisen in the course of natural cycles. You haven't reordered the cosmos in any fundamental way, but you have found a something that can power something to change things. And you've locked that into, a nice gingham lidded, talisman, right? Mm-hmm. And I like that analogy a lot because it gets at the husbandry of it all. I like the agricultural analogy. I like the fact that it's a combination of nature's going to do what nature's going to do, but there are also things you can do about it once it's done. And the other aspect of it is what is the wider history of magic, right? Of calling these astrological sigils, the very particular markings and passwords and strange names and things that you would carve onto something or imprint on something or cast on these metal medallions, which were called sigils. And I'm interested in the comparison of where we get from early modern astrological sigils of very particular shapes to chaos magic sigils via Austin Osman Spare, where they become, and I mean this absolutely respectfully, DIY magic squiggles, right? Astrological sigils are particular things. It has to be this mark, has to be this way up for, you know, Venus to send its spirits to that thing. It has to have the right address on it. Whereas chaos magic says you can construct these yourself. And I'm interested in where we get from one to the other.
That is a very interesting progression. There's also the element with those amulets and their creation. Well, two things. One, because it's using, you know, natural processes of, like you said, capturing astrological influences, then that is a more palatable thing from the standpoint of like 17th century and trying to explain it from a quote unquote rational explanation. So you're not.
The moon's affecting the tides, right? You know, exactly. It's this kind of explanation, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. If you plant something at the wrong time, it's not going to grow. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't require us to believe that everything is run by demons. Again, this is the notion of like emergent natural magic from the Renaissance humanism, as opposed to this more medieval idea that God gets very annoyed when we try and find out how things work and just wants us to leave everything alone and just, you know, do what we're told.
But that
as opposed to a...
And then that also gets to the fact that that's around the time when there were elements of it that potentially had more shall we say, magic-y or Catholic elements that were kind of eventually kind of getting excised out of it around the Reformation and things like that? Because I know that that time period is one of your specialties and is very interesting.
Yeah, the old issue emerges again, basically, that, like, what are these names you're carving into a thing? It's one thing to work with natural forces and, you know, the moon's lunary spirits of dream might be classed as natural forces. You know, just because it's magic doesn't mean it occurs outside of the realm of physics to an early modern perspective. Mm-hmm. This idea that magic is what happens anomalously or out, you know, against nature is a very strange idea to many of our pre-modern forebears. So the issue very much becomes, how do you engage with that in a way that doesn't raise the hackles of the church necessarily, which is partly about what you're talking to, is partly about how images even work, whether or not that's because there's demons behind the demons. We enter into a realm of discussing what are considered licit versus illicit magical practices, rather than any kind of idea about, like, this is okay, this is science, and this is not okay, this is magic. That doesn't mm-hmm. happen for a very long time.
Yeah. There's a lot more rabbit holes we could go down there. I just wanted to take a slight moment. I realized that earlier I did not mention to people that if you have questions, there is a chat button. The best way is to use the Q&A button, because I will be more likely to see it. But if you want to throw a question in the chat, you can. But the Q&A is easier and better to use. If you do use the chat function, you can change it from panelists only to attendees and panelists. But again, if it's just a question, just put it in the Q&A. I'll try to get to it. From that, talking about magic in the 17th century and amulets and other marks and sigils, I think that it is interesting at that point, another huge subject to dive into, but the excellent book that you mentioned earlier in the interview. For people who are not familiar with the excellent book, can you just give us a brief rundown of who wrote it and a little about it? I know it's hard to summarize, but...
It's kind of your job when you write a book to be able to summarize, but I appreciate the kind softballing of that question, and thank you. I would much rather do that than, you know, and have a nice chat than you know, feel like I'm being grilled or anything. So the Excellent Book of the Art of Magic is a text that we find in a compilation of texts in a bunch of short magical treatises that were all shoved together and bound together as, you know, with the very sexy title of Additional Manuscript 36674. Within that are a bunch of different texts. There's a Key of Solomon, there's a Thesaurus Spiritum, which is a particular other kind of genre of grimoire, of handbooks of dealing with conjuring spirits. But what marks the excellent book as particularly interesting and important is that, as I said, it doesn't just have a grimoire. It doesn't just have a handbook of instructions of, you know, when you want to summon a spirit, first you must, you know, draw a circle like this. Then you must, recite this Latin. Then you must, you know, wave this sword in this direction. It has all that stuff. But what it also has is the dream journal and the record of the visions and scrying and trance sessions that these two individuals had. That help them receive the further instructions of the grimoire. So what we have is basically somewhere between a director's cut and a behind the scenes of how this grimoire actually emerged. And that's very rare. Mm-hmm. People copy out grimoires more frequently than they copy out their own diaries. Funnily enough, right? Like not so strange to understand, right? Even professional magicians, are often very, you know, private about like certain aspects of their personal practices. And so to get this, to see not just, an instruction like you shouldn't try and capture a spirit in a stone for longer than 24 hours. I mean, that's a fascinating instruction in of itself. But to find out from the dream journal, from the visions, that advice was given by the ghost of a dead magician that turned up, telling them like how to do good magic, there's a whole new layer of like what's going on there and how this stuff emerges. And so what interested Phil and myself about it were a number of factors. Chiefly, I mean, one of the main things that I'm about, we mentioned earlier, the making the magic circle a positive feedback loop, is I'm, as a historian and as a practitioner, I and as a necromancer, I work with the ghosts of a lot of these historical magicians. And what better place, as far as I'm concerned, to learn necromancy than from dead necromancers, right? And so this text, when I came across it, I was fascinated because there are multiple famous dead magicians, both like definitely historical figures, like the ghost of Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa and of Roger Bacon, turning up for them to give these two guys, Humphrey Gilbert and John Davies, advice. They're doing this in 1567, from February to April, roughly. And it starts with the dream of Solomon, with King Solomon, very, very important figure in Grimoiric magic. It, you know, lends his name to Solomonic magic, like one of the bywords for particular kinds of European conjuration and spirit work. And it's the dream of Solomon that gives Gilbert probably this prayer, which says, like, you know, amongst other things, you know, I'm about to talk to a bunch more spirits, and Solomon says it's okay, and by his authority I can do this stuff. So it's the whole work is started by a dream of a dead magician, an important dead magician, turning up and saying, I give you license to do this thing, and here are some tips on how to do it. And then a bunch more dead magicians turn up, from Agrippa, Bacon, a bunch of biblical figures like Job, Saint Luke, but then also Adam, like the first magician, right? The first geomancer, the first gardener, who also has a very, you know, seasonable advice. And that's what interested me primarily. It was this layer of the necromancy of necromancy that's present in early modern magic, and the way that they seem to bridge a couple different kinds of conjuration style. So in brief, Agrippa outlines these two ways that you can work with unclean spirits, which is what they're definitely doing, amongst other things. They're working with angels as well, but they're definitely working with fallen angels and demonic princes, shall we say, because they're interested in the material world. They're not just interested in what's happening in heaven. So who do you ask about that? Agrippa outlines two different ways in which you can work with malevolent spirits, one of which is to threaten them with the names of God. So that's your, you know, that's your demonologist priest, you know. And Agrippa says, this isn't great because you shouldn't deal with unclean spirits at all, but at least you're like holding them at arm's length because they all fear the name and virtue of the creator. The second version, he says, is even worse, which is where you're actually worshiping these unclean spirits and you're making offerings to them and things like that. Mm-hmm. What we get from the changing work that Gilbert and Davies are doing in the excellent book of The Art of Magic is that they start off and they are, Gilbert is cursing up a storm. He's constantly telling these, you know, he's constantly getting these spirits to do what he wants by threatening them with, you know, holy water, with excommunication, with a sword, which is not an unstandard way of practicing. There's this notion that, you know, spirits aren't just there to do what you want. You know, at best, they might be wild animals who might be interested in what you're doing, but are most likely not going to be. Many of them attest in these visions and these scrying that they don't want to be caught. They don't want to be captured. They don't want to be told what to do. You know, this is not an unreasonable position, but he is cursing so vehemently, and he is, you know, doing these huge lists of all the saints that rebuke you and how God will never look at you again, that in the end, Saint Luke, the evangelist, turns up and says, mate, you got to stop all this swearing. Like, this is too much. I will step in and direct unclean spirits on your behalf. And that's interesting because he's a holy figure, but he's also compelling them. He's also working with them by the way they want to be worked. So you can't be too compelly. You also can't be too chummy. But somewhere in between is getting in another holy figure who's already an intermediary as an evangelist, right? Who is then able to boss those spirits around on your behalf. And that's a really interesting third option, mm-hmm. that you see in a lot of sorcerous practices that are around not just I will hire a spirit to do this thing, but I will, in order to get at that spirit, I might need to hire another spirit as an intermediary. I might need an agent. My agent might need an agent, depending on what it is and what you're trying to do. And so, yeah, there are these couple factors, the necromancy that's there, and there are other features of necromancy as well. It's not just dead magicians. They're mm-hmm. also working with Azazel as the ruler of the bones of the dead, the keeper of the dry bones, which is, again, a 16th century tradition. They utilize a particular set of kings of the cardinal directions, the spirits of Oriens, Paimon, Maimon, and Egin. Paimon got a a bit more of a guest feature recently in the horror movie Hereditary. And so the internet got a bit of flutter about that. But these are figures of at least early modern Goetia and necromancy, black magic, that were being called to not visit plagues upon your enemies or, you know, tell you what the King of Poland is up to, but to give you information, mostly to teach you magic. Mm-hmm. Summoning spirits of varying sorts to teach you how to do magic in order to do better magic, to summon more senior and effective teaching spirits to learn more magic. Again, this positive feedback loop coming in is really interesting to me.
So I'm curious about, because obviously, as you just mentioned, this element of necromancy and the work that they did with the dead, whether like kind of we're talking about King Solomon or Bacon, they were calling upon these and then being helped by these dead magicians and other necromantic spirits. You mentioned that you think this is a really good thing, that this is a part of your practice. I'd be curious to hear, you know, what you can share about that and how that is a part of your practice. But then also, are there any issues that are raised for that? I mean, for example, like Gilbert and Davies were very much products of their time and you know, there are elements of their work that is troubling because of the worldview that they lived in. So they're kind of, one could consider that they might be like troubled dead in some way. Like, how does that, is there any concern that you have in terms of how you work with like those spirits? Or are you more of the tradition of like, well, we're dealing with King Solomon here or Adam. That's not going to be the same as someone like, you know, Gilbert or something like that.
I think I understand the question. So So when we talk about, we often talk about working with the dead as if they're a monolith. Mm-hmm. I think we deal with a couple of things here. One of them might be looking at it from traditions, right? Looking at the actual dead folks around someone versus the, you know, to use a Wiccan term, the mighty dead that they, and to think about the mighty dead, not just in terms of their relationality to you. So beloved dead being blood dead or family and mighty dead being like magical lineage or influence on you. Not as a set of relationships, but as a set of like how stable are they in the afterlife, in the spirit world. And again, this concept of like the ambient dead, that if you don't like, there are many takes that amongst other things, several things that might happen to multiple parts of the soul, that if we don't maintain coherence through a variety of ways, you know, special mental exercises, pacts with spirits or gods, ensuring that your descendants keep your, you know, name and picture on their tongues and walls, that you will kind of melt into the kind of great ocean of the dead, and that you can cohere out of it. And so in many like ancestral veneration exercises, I'm thinking especially of practices, I'm thinking especially of like Daniel 4 and his ancestral medicine, who has some Ifa training, I believe. Mm-hmm. You are looking for stable or elevated dead that can help you work with the less stable dead of your family. Mm-hmm. and that are around you, the local dead as well. So to return to your point, Gilbert's a monster. Let me be clear. Like he's a terrible, terrible man. Like his campaign in Ireland is regarded as bloodthirsty, even by the military folks who are like, yep, we'll kill all the Irish, it's fine. But not like that. Wow. Lining the roads with the heads of women and children. It's a bit much, God. Gilbert. Like, yeah, he's a full-on monster. Like, so I have no doubt that he's also surrounded by hosts of Irish dead. Absolutely. He doesn't mention that stuff. And why would he? Right. Yeah. No, he's very interested in God, in these saints and holy people telling him that he's going to be a saint if he does it right. Mm-hmm. He dies shouting something about how he couldn't possibly drown on a burning, on a burning sinking ship, at having been attacked by pirates. So, yeah, which is a subject of a wonderful set of engravings, if you're interested in looking at those. Mm-hmm. I don't want to start talking about like comeuppance or things around that. As for my work, so this is, you know, this for me is the piece where on the one hand, like my different engagements with this stuff, academic, you know, scholarship and, you know, practical practice and then client work, all kind of come together. For me, I work with some figures that we could call mythic. So, you know, Adam and Eve are both important as first ancestors in my practice, mm-hmm. And certainly as first geomancers and gardeners. And that helped. But I also work with particular dead magicians and especially around cunning folk, dead mm-hmm. cunning folk, particular cunning folk and generally those traditions. And for me, the necromancy is a necessary part because I'm not a reconstructionist. Like, I don't consider myself to be trying to live in the 17th century or as the 17th century service magicians would have. That said, I am utilizing my study of their techniques to do service for clients. Like, I am very much like them. I didn't want to write my new bio. So I got the excellent book came out through Scarlet Imprint. And so I imposed on them to write my bio for me because I hate doing them. And they described me as a contemporary cunning man, which I was delighted at. I'm not going to lie, because again, I think it's one of those things to declare oneself a bit smart, a bit cunning, a bit capable at magic is kind of one of those things that has to be labeled onto you, I think. So outside of my own identity crises, I am not doing exactly what 17th century cunning folk were doing, because we now have insurance companies and a police force and a couple of other things that they would have been providing for people. So some of the social functions aren't the same, and we don't live in those conditions exactly. So am I a cunning man, or am I a necromancer who calls up cunning men to help do the same kinds of work sometimes as them? I'm not sure. But that, for me, is where this is, how necromancy can provide a way of bridging the contrasts of our times. So I'm working with the ghosts that still want to turn up and help me work out how to help clients.
And that, mostly. like you mentioned, that creates a positive feedback loop of, you know, you're working with those who have gone before that have done those things so that you can do better magic in order to connect more with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's also where my work with the Magi comes in. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's been my experience that utilizing the virtues of the three wise men, the three holy kings of Cologne, is like it's an umbrella or a muster point under which I can meet with various other dead magicians. And mm-hmm. even though, you know, I have a lot of Catholic iconography for someone who isn't quite sure if they're Catholic or not, I do that stuff for my dead. Like I go to mass for them, like on occasion. Mm-hmm. And I use those statues because they're the statues that my ancestors would have looked at. And again, I'm praying with them. We've got Patrick and Joseph days coming up. Those are both like names that my family have longstanding pacts with or parts of them. And so that's often the only way that you can get hold of those dead, because, you know, people with this kind of accent came and, you know, burned the records and killed people that remembered those kinds of things in Ireland as well. Not to get too up on our, you know, oppression Olympics or anything, but being able to say, we can't remember, but I know we have, you know, generations of Patricks going back and talking to them on Patrick's Day is really useful for me.
Yeah.
So engaging with the dead on their terms becomes, I think, really important, while also understanding that you're in the driving seat. You know, you're the one that's the responsibility and the privilege to be alive right now. You are the living, breathing, blossoming end of that current reaching family limb mm-hmm. of that family tree, and that's a beautiful and powerful thing as well. We shouldn't have to be hostage to everything our dead do, but we carry them with us, and like any other kind of, you know, huge emotional response, we either deal with it consciously or we repress it and it comes out sideways.
Mm-hmm. And that's also what you're doing then, is a carrying forward of that folk cunning tradition, which very much involves the dead. And
that's the idea. I hope. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do some I'm doing some research at the moment with my friend Aaron, who's also similarly works cunning and is, you know, also attempting to have an honest historical engagement with, like, I do the same things. I'm not in the same place and time. But we talk about the Grandcestors a bunch. Especially the dead of cunning women, who were even less reported than cunning men were. And there seems still to be a strange feature whereby these folk magical practitioners were often also, you know, literate or at least semi-literate. Some were even Latinate. And we have this idea that, you know, a folk magician is someone who's, you know, mucking about with mud and sticks and can maybe cure your sheep of something, but doesn't know anything about like the planets or any like high ceremonial magic. And that's not the case at all. You get very complicated grimoire magic going on with otherwise very folksy rural practitioners. And you get it even, you know, and the element that interests Sarah and I at the moment is about how if you had a book, you could be a cunning man, but if you had a book and you're a woman who worked cunning, you were at the very least just a cunning woman and never a grimoire magician, either then or now. And you were also far more likely to, you know, be accused of witchcraft for having the devil's book, the Book of the Beasts, right? And so that's a really fascinating layer as well of looking at the known dead and also the unknown dead. Because when we study these people, we study the outliers who were taken to court very often. That's how we know about them sometimes, is someone complained about them. So that also raises work with the unknown dead, the unknown cunning women, the ones that, you know, served their communities very happily and no one ever complained about them.
Yeah, and the ones that did not get hauled in front of the court and therefore we don't know their names. But that's. And that's a very interesting point about the ways in which we relate to those ancestors. You brought up a point, I believe at one point, that some of the ways that folk practices around saints are practiced kind of has some relationality with practices that would be done for the dead, or especially like restless dead, because there are elements of saint practice that kind of border on that, where you are kind of, you're saint bothering in a sense. You're bothering them and asking them for things, which is the same way that you might bother the spirit of dead magician or some other person.
It goes way further. Mm-hmm. It's not just about like, you know, asking them for the things you'd ask for other dead people. It's that the technology is also very similar. I'm gonna steal a line or a point that my dear friend Jesse Hathaway Diaz, who I do a podcast with of our own, loves to make, which is, yeah, there is a way that you can look at an awful lot of Catholic saint practices as deliberately engineering restless dead, doing all the things that you would do that you would normally not do when someone dies, keeping their bones, keeping them lit, keeping words constantly said, prodding them constantly, agitating them in very particular ways, mm-hmm. keeping them under an altar where you are constantly opening a portal to heaven, in order that they are made restless so that those restless dead can be fed into the dynamo of the church itself, so that they can power prayers. Yeah, you get exactly the same. It's explicitly necromancy. So you get the fourth book of occult philosophy talking about like, why is it that we visit saints' bones if they're in heaven now and they can hear us anywhere? Actually, they can hear you better if you pray into their bones, which means if you own their bones, you have more access to their power. Mm-hmm. If you keep them wet, you can do certain things. If you dry them, you can do certain things. If you keep them in the dark, you can do certain things that are directly like whoever writes that of magical ceremonies in the pseudo Agrippan collection of the fourth book of occult philosophy is very clear that like, oh yeah, this is necromancy you can do with like the bones of, you know, a suicide. And that's exactly what they're doing in the church as well. Like, and not in a, and that's why the church is a hypocrites kind of way, but in a, because that's how the world works.
Yes.
So building restless dead, deliberately agitating them, keeping them safely agitated, I guess we could argue, mm-hmm. Within the institution to do certain things, to answer prayers, to ensure, proper maintenance of the good old status quo.
Yeah. And that goes back, I mean, a lot further than Christianity, to the Greeks and the Romans and the hero cults and things like that, where they were
Yeah, and there are also like some real differences there. Yeah. Like again, Peter Brown's Cult of the Saints is great for this. On the one hand, yes, saints are absolutely like folk heroes or like like demigods. You know, they have their strange stories. They have a close relationship with the divine. Their lives are surrounded with miracles. Those kinds of things. In some ways, they're very different. And Brown does a good job of showing that. An awful lot of, you know, contemporaneous pagans were like, you're doing what with the bones of your holy people? That's weird. And not just on a, like, they call each other brother and sister, they must be practicing incest. Like that classic, you know, their religion is a cult and my cult is a religion stuff. I don't just mean that. They're very different. They are, you know, if anything, they're getting more grubby and weird than most, like, pagan hero cults are. So there are you know, because there's also a conception of the difference between, you know, whether or not the hero is dead or you know, where heaven is or still around. Like, it's definitely worth us thinking about in the same terms because it comes full back around again. And by the time you come to the Reformation, a lot of Protestant writers are very categorically, you know, eliding Catholic hagiography and saint practices with pagan hero worship and things like that. And so it becomes the full circle, right? So you get Scott complaining that people are taking waxen images of their husband's penises to St. Anthony's altar in order that he might have more courage, right? And doing it in the vein of like, have you seen what these like stupid and like papists are doing, right? But also people were doing that as well. And so the sacred and the profane meet in a way, yeah, in a very explicitly necromantic way. And I think it's very useful for us moderns trying to deal with disenchantment to look at the Catholic Church and be like, this is just Italian OG goth witchcraft, right? And it is on many levels in terms of what you're actually doing. But I think it's also worth us bearing in mind that it looks like that because of where we are in history and because of a very shallow history of quote disenchantment, which is a very Eurocentric concept in of itself, to be clear. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's levels at which this is absolutely a witchcraft, but then a witchcraft is also its own kind of set of descriptions and definitions and things. And I think it's worth us bearing in mind that certainly if we're dealing with our own dead, our own ancestors who may be willing to come forth and teach us a thing or two, most of them that I've encountered are absolutely not interested in being called witches.
Oh yeah.
Which is the other part of this, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Especially the ones that did, you know, Maleficia. You don't call me that. You don't use that word in this house, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. It's very important to try as best as we can to get out of our own way or, you know, the very brief blip of our culture's association with that word, which is very, very different from our ancestors' conception. So,
yeah. I think my concept again comes back to my big nan, right? Mm-hmm. She didn't think what she did was witchcraft.
Yeah.
And she certainly didn't think going to church and drinking the blood of the savior was vampirism or witchcraft, but you could, from a modern perspective, go and get a hell of a lot out of Catholicism as this transgressive practice against, you know, Western materialism, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that denies the actual, the reality, as far as I'm concerned, of Catholic witchcraft, which is what you did after the Mass, which is all the secret stuff you know, whispered into things and shoved into cracks in the saint or chipped off bits of the stonework of the church and went and did stuff with. Like, that's the witchcraft, as far as I'm concerned, is not just treating a state religion like it's weird, but actually what the weird stuff was you did after and before and around and didn't tell the priest, mm-hmm. you know? So I think there's a difference between Catholicism as witchcraft and Catholic witchcraft. Mm-hmm.
And that also brings into like, you know, that same discussion of what's been remembered, what's actually survived, and all the things that I'm sure were extremely interesting that those cunning folk did or had or practices, people that weren't cunning folk, just people like your nan that, you know, had those practices. It's not going to get written down, but it's very, very much the essence of their practice. So
yeah. And then you get those working books, those which are a combination of like recipe books and like notebooks and, you know, odd, you know, scratching out like that incense recipe and things like that, but also contain whole like extracts and excerpts of, you know, deep academic occult theory and things like the Grimoire of Arthur Gauntlet, which is Sloan manuscript 3851, I think, which was published by Avalonia a couple of years back and edited by David Rankin, which is the working book of this 17th century London cunning man. Arthur Gauntlet is a fantastic name. And it reads sometimes like he's leaving a record for someone else, you know? Yeah. Like, why is he writing out? This isn't just a reference book for you to remember, like, do I use 3 spoonfuls of mercury or 2? You know, this is, it looks like he's preparing something to hand over to someone. And that, again, obviously I'm interested in that reception, because sometimes some cunning folk did train other cunning folk. Anne Bodenham studied under Dr. Lamb. Like, we know that. And that, you know, that helped her for a while until Dr. Lamb was like pilloried through the streets of London with people throwing things at him for being a necromancer. Then suddenly her like, oh, don't worry, she's not a witch, she learned it from Dr. Lamb, becomes completely inverted.
Yeah.
Some did pass things on. Some found some seem to be some like family traditions of like, okay, now granddad's dad, you have to go and do the thing he did with the apple trees now, which can be its own family tradition stuff. But also in a couple cases was like, and now you are the person that everyone in a 20-mile radius comes to about this thing. Mm-hmm. But other times it was people kind of cobbling it together from themselves, from their own studies and what they could get hold of. Mm-hmm. And so that, yeah, that really interests me, a tradition or which doesn't, yeah. How do we think about these traditions and their honoring and their celebration in ways that don't overwrite them with our own, you know, proclivities and also our own real concerns and difficulties that we're facing that aren't the same.
Yeah.
While also acknowledging that, while not freezing them as a dead thing. I'm an early modernist, so I'm mostly going to talk about 17th century cunning folk. But, you know, work of Owen Davies and other historians has shown that people are still doing this stuff now, you know, and that there wasn't necessarily a break. There was a break in the study of it, especially around the end of the 18th and 19th century. But we you know, cunning moral and all sorts of other practitioners of varying degrees of fame. So it isn't an isolated tradition, I want to say. But is it, you know, are you the same by doing that thing? Is it even a useful question to be like, when do I get to declare that I'm a cunning person, right? Is that even a useful question, or should the work be leading the way? You know,
should it be put into your bio by someone else?
Yes, if it can be put in your bio and someone else, I'm delighted at that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, because that feels like the closest thing,
exactly,
but, to what I do.
Yeah, and I think it's very important, that point of not trying to freeze any of this in place, because that isn't how.
I have a lot of really, really useful conversations with friends and colleagues and family who are conjure workers, conjure doctors, involved in Southern conjure and African-American hoodoo and root work, about these similar kinds of things of to what extent are we trying to, you know, continue to nurture the roots of our traditions without saying, like, you know, past 1932, this ain't real wrestling anymore, right? Do you honor the tradition by like freezing it in time and saying nothing else before or after this point counts? For a tradition that's like meant to be about helping people, or help people help themselves, like, I'm not sure, you know. But equally, you know, I think just declaring myself, you know, old Goody Cummins, and you know. I don't know, maybe if I could cultivate a perfect cottage core Instagram as well, maybe that would be enough. Maybe that would be inspiring to people and helpful in some way. But that feels not enough for me. I want to try and have a firmer basis by which I can stand and help other people stand.
I think that your practice is absolutely wonderful, and I'm so glad that you offer what you do for people. So that is a wonderful thing for all of us. So there was a question that came in the Q&A. What are your thoughts on the ways magic was practiced during this period? I'm assuming he's talking the 17th century, your specialty, affected the arts like music and art. How are these ideals expressed through the arts?
I'm a huge fan of humoral theory and trying to talk about why humoral theory isn't just a personality test or bad medicine, mm-hmm. Although it was utilized as both. And I think we see that most clearly in arts and music. And that's a place where I think there's a lot of occult philosophy going on that, how do I frame this? I'm really glad English Lit is looking at Shakespeare and the humors. I just posted an article about that today. I think it's great and really helpful for us understanding when humoral theory provided sorcerous literalism as opposed to this kind of sensory figuratism. What's an example of that? So, trying to ensure that you cultivate sanguine, nice, calm, joyous, relaxed, intellectual virtues by sweetening people, by... for instance, there's a whole practice of rubbing honey over your, around your lips so that when you speak, your words are sweet. All right. Now these things survive as figurative language for us, bitter words, looking daggers and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't that anyone actually thought that if you hated someone enough, literal daggers would come out of your eyes. But there was a sense that the feeling of anger wasn't entirely just within yourself mm-hmm. and didn't entirely just come from yourself, that you're drawing on influences of things that have happened to you that you're reacting against, and that you are leaking that influence out into the world. The angry man makes his world angrier, but he also habituates himself to become more angry more easily. So it's habituation and so humoral theory, I think, is very, very interesting. And I'm very grateful that English Lit people and art historians are very big on looking at the emblems of it. And most of the time it's look at these really complicated ways that we think about salamanders or undines or, or the winds or any of these other kinds of factors. And then there'll be a short explanation that says and these were linked to the four classical elements and the four humors and the underlay health. And that's it. Yeah. So in answer to your actual question, we definitely see the idea of the elementated world reacting with itself in a range of Renaissance art. You mm-hmm. also get people becoming way more interested in their own, in exploring their nativities. So you get a bunch of different, relatively wealthy Italians commissioning whole basilicas or interior plazas with their nativity writ large in mythological types around the building in order to explore the options that were open to them. So rather than seeing it as this is your life, this is your fate, seeing those things as here are the points you're weak and you need to defend. Here are the points you're strong and you can rely. And so we definitely see the humoral element in art. You see it in music, in the idea of, or in a bunch of ideas around. Music is from Pythagoras at least has been one of the main ways to talk about action at a distance. Mm-hmm. Right, the lute strings that hum across the room because you're playing a thing here. That's one of the primary ways that the talk about harmonic resonances and how you get maths into physics and how you and how it's demonstrable of half the string produces this thing. So music becomes the go-to of explaining how magic even works, as well as having a bunch of occult content to it. So mm-hmm. Ficino. Classically, right, playing his fiddle possibly setting Orphic hymns to tune. Mm-hmm. And we also get, so we're out of the realm of where is magic in music and more, where's the music in magic here? And I apologize if I'm twisting the question in classic politician way. But I'm also very interested in where a bunch of early modern Italian grimoires that I'm particularly interested in that deal with a kind of mixture of angels and unclean spirits, the Grimoire in Verum, for instance. Jake would kill me for saying that it contains angels, sorry. The previous Grimoire to that, the Clavicula Salomonis de Secretis, has a bunch of stuff that looks like the Latin says that you sing a bunch of these incantations. You don't just declare them in a big sonorous, Golden Dawn, I did 2 years of acting kind of way. You you're fully singing them. And if that's the case, what are the tunes they're using? So exploring what early modern like tradition, like trad ars look like, what were the stock tunes and things that people would roughly be drawing on to sing these incantations to spirits rather than just speak them aloud or command them.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that especially. I hope that was anywhere near around what you were asking.
Oh no, that was, I think that was, yes, that was, excellent. And it is, it's a huge topic to explore. I mean, obviously there's, a couple thousand years of theory.
And there's, you know, there's a huge movement in visual culture around that time as well, around realizing that the profound problems it causes a humanist movement that's like, maybe God wants us to explore the world. Maybe the evidence of our eyes and ears and taste buds and minds, like discussing this stuff, is piety. Maybe we honor God by exploring the book of nature, by trying to read the book of nature, and then coming across optical illusions. And like, that sounds silly, but that's a very, that's one of the factors that causes this immense like study of the epistemology of doubt, of studying how we make truth claims in the face of when our senses tell us things that aren't the case. And that epistemology of doubt, Stuart Clark's Vanities of the Eye is a particularly great text for this. And what that does to epistemology in general in the period, what it does to how people think they can make truth claims at all. And so art is responding to all of this stuff. This is the period where you also get Robert Flood do it, you know, prefiguring Malevich and doing a black square of his own, trying to depict infinity or void, right? So along with that, you've got attendant ideas about natural language. So the Adamic tongue, whether that's John Dee and Edward Kelly trying to get back to the original language of paradise that Adam used to name all the beings, that if we can speak the true language of creation, we can get at truth claims again, despite all of this confusing stuff in the world. And that plays directly into, you know, Enochian stuff and how to talk to angels, but it's also getting at the same, like, there's a reality here that we can't get at yet. There's an underlying, and not in a distant Empyrean realm, in a right here and now, there is a secret name for that plant, right? And you know, you might want to try and learn that. So art at the time, and music at a lesser extent, I guess, is struggling with these magical concepts as well as expressing them. So there's a lot to explore. Sorry, I got very excited about that.
No, there were a lot of huge change. I can't speak so much to visual arts and nor the literary, but there were a lot of huge changes in music at that time that were probably also reflecting those complete revolutions in thought and what could be done and why, which impacted what they were creating. So, but anyway, huge, wonderful topic. So interesting. I wanted to ask, I like to end with, there's two questions. One, you mentioned an article that you just released today. Can you tell us about some of the projects that you were working on currently and where people can find that and classes that you might be teaching or other things like that that you're doing?
Sure. Yeah. I just posted. I didn't write that one. It was from the Wellcome Trust.
Oh, okay.
I think I should be clear. That's my fault. It's so easy to like take credit for things that aren't yours. I'm teaching a course at the moment on Cunningcraft, the Cunningcraft Foundation, which is a 6-week course. We're into our second or third week, but the recordings of that like live cycle will be available once it's finished. If folks want to dive into looking at the divination, the unbewitching, the conjuration, and even the kind of nigromancy that the cunning folk were up to, along with, you know, reflections on what that means for modern practice. Mm-hmm. I'm also teaching a modular series at the moment on working with the dead through Catland Books, who are based in Brooklyn. And in the before four times, I would go and teach there in person. It was nice to engage with you know, community there I wouldn't otherwise get to. And they've switched to online teaching, as most people have. And so I'm doing a series of modular classes. So it's a 4-part series, but each part is dealing with a different aspect of working with the dead that can stand alone. So we did ancestors last week, and then this week is about teaching dead. So mighty dead and tutelary shades and the kind of stuff that you know, that I work through, you know, engagement with the excellent book and its records and things, as well as other kinds of ways of different kinds of magical individuals, like historic, not just historical, but historic figures, influences, inspirations, literal like family magicians, as well as, you know, exploring those kinds of things. And in the coming weeks, talking, the one after that is on the local dead. So working like your, you know, your nearest graveyard and things, which again, getting at that, like what else has happened in this space? There are no tabula rasas, right? Which is a wonderful post-colonialist reflection, I think. And then the final one is about the restless dead, and about, you know, how do you know if you're haunted and those kinds of things. So concentration on the things I do. I'm always finding a place to bang on about geomancy, it seems, as well. I have a class coming up for Morbid Anatomy in like May, I think. More classes on cunning craft. What else do we do? Oh, the other fun thing I've been doing with Jesse, who's my podcast co-host, we've been doing like an online cabaret for fancy necromancers called The Speakeasy of the Dead, which is in an era where we're all getting a little like Zoom fatigued more easily. I used to do cabarets. I was saying, like, I used to like coordinate and MC them. And so getting three of our mates in to do 20-minute presentations on something really interesting, and then some people talking about some cool art. We have our friend Sasha Ravitch, who's a very gifted astrologer and astrological magician, who does the Dead Weather Report, which is, you know, so over the next month, here are the elections to bear in mind. Here's the star weather for if you want to be working with your ancestors or sending out vengeful dead against your, you know, ex-boss or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a lovely little, like, variety show of, like, here's 10 minutes on this weird plant. Here's, you know, 20 minutes on, gosh, you know, Balkan saint magic or other kinds of sources. And so they've been really fun. And we have another one coming up in April, start of April, I think we're going to do.
I can't believe I haven't heard of that before. So that sounds very
we're just
cool.
Kind of doing it as an experiment. It's also just awesome, you know? Yeah. And we charge like a nominal, like $7 as cover, mm-hmm. and then just donate that to a charity every time. So we've given to a center for helping arson victims, the Phoenix Center, I think it was called.
Yes.
A couple other things for specific to New York homelessness and other bits and pieces of trying to support a community and give something back as well.
Yeah. Oh, I'll get those details from you so that I can put how to sign up and all that other stuff, good stuff, in the show notes when this is posted, because definitely I'm sure there will be people that want to be involved. And then my last question to you, just before as we wrap up, is, mm-hmm. is there anything in particular, whether it's about divination or these folk, you know, the necromantic practices that you're talking about, is there any advice or practices that you kind of want to share or think are particularly important for people to keep in mind? It's a deliberately vague, open-ended question. That is what it is. So you can take it however you like.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I think it's a great question. I think navigating tensions in our own practices around, how do I frame this? Ensuring that you're getting something useful out of it. I think it can be very easy to invest in the feeling and the ego identification of these things precisely because they are important and powerful. And I'm not trying to say like, don't be like this asshole that I don't like, or like, it's very easy to rant like that when you see people doing, you know, things that don't look safe or ethical or sustainable. But mostly it has to be a self-directed endeavor, right? We have to look at a thing and say, is this helping me? Am I building good character? Is the thing that I've become really interested in. Is this helping me? And it doesn't mean it has to be an obvious, like, yes, I raised all this money for this charity or something like that. And it doesn't have to be, if I don't get anything out of this immediately, I'm not going to do it. It's that tension between things being able to deplete you as well as nourish you, and working out, am I doing this and it's hard because it's hard and I'll be better for it? Am I doing it? Am I being pig-headed about this? And constantly, you know, constantly eternal vigilance and examining our own, like, our own motivations and our own feelings around a thing, and attempting to, for me, a lot of this practice is not, I don't want to go so far as to say it's all about, you know, enlightening and elevating my soul, but it's certainly about trying to be more responsible on my part about what I am projecting and leaking out into the world through my porous mind, body, soul, self complex, and trying to be emotionally responsible, because, you know, these magic things will come out one way or another, whether it's consciously worded tactfully or coming out sideways and doing the magical equivalent of, you know, screaming in traffic for no apparent reason. So I would you know, encourage people to look for the opportunities to practice and cultivate good character in their practices, whatever those are, and to do things that help you return to yourself and to your own, you know. One of my teachers loves to talk about, there is a crossroads at the top and the bottom of each and every breath, and that is the place we return to ourselves. We're able, on a good day, to return to ourselves and to, you know, that whole strength to change what I can, patience to change what I can't, and wisdom to know the difference, right? How to hold the rudder at the crossroads and know where you can block off the things that aren't helpful and move towards that which is. And when, you know, storms are coming, and the best we can do is ride it out, you know. So I hope that wasn't too ramble, but yeah, find the opportunities to practice good character in your practice.
I think that is absolutely lovely and wonderful. So thank you, Dr. Al. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and we didn't even really get that much into geomancy. So next time.
Well, as you probably gathered, I will be like, oh, but that's another thing that's great about geomancy.
I know.
I'm sorry for minorly evangelizing about it, but I've had a wonderful time.
I love it. So yes. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you to everyone who was here live, and thank you to everyone who's listening afterwards. So I'll see you all. Bye.
Wonderful. Bye, everyone.
That was a wonderful discussion with Dr. Al, and I'm already looking forward to the next time, hopefully. I'm including links to some of his books and to the cabaret he mentioned, as well as to his website and his podcast. I definitely recommend checking out all his work, which is truly excellent. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you to everyone who joined in live and submitted questions. Please subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you enjoy what we're doing here. It really helps. And check out our website at coffeeanddivination.com. You can also find me on Twitter, where I am at @FiddleAngel. Enjoy your journeys with divination, and I'll see you next time.